yea, oh yea, oh yea. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw, near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. In re, Nolo Press, an original mandamus proceeding. Temple Inland Forest Products versus Martin Reeves Carter Sr. and Larry Wilton from Jasper County. Ingersoll Rand Company versus Valero Energy Corporation from Nueces County. And Rocky Mountain Helicopters versus Lubbock County Hospital District from Lubbock County. In each of these causes, the court has allowed each side 20 minutes to present oral argument. Relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete these arguments before noon. If you desire to purchase a tape of any argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. Court is ready to hear oral argument from Relator.
May it please the court.
Let me also say Justice Abbott is not sitting in the first case, but will be in all other cases.
May it please the court. Mr. Peter Kennedy will present argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Kennedy, and I represent Relator Nolo Press. This is an original mandamus proceeding seeking from this court an order directing the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee to release to Relator and to the public certain information regarding the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee's rules and regulations, the composition of its subcommittees, basic information about its meeting times, dates, schedules, and agendas, and particular information about the investigation of my client, Nolo Press. An issue before this court is whether the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee will be regulated by the same type of open and fair proceedings that are applicable to other government agencies.
What proceedings is happening in the Unauthorized Practice of Law? What do you think is going on?
The current status as to my client, Nolo Press, is it has been notified that it is subject of an investigation by the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee's subcommittee in Dallas, and had been, until this court stayed the hearing, had been requested to appear at a hearing before the Dallas subcommittee on August 20th of 1998.
Does the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee have any authority other than to bring a lawsuit to seek a judicial determination of whether or not Nolo Press is practicing law unauthorizedly?
According to the subcommittee rules that were produced to us after we filed this lawsuit, yes, it does. It has significant authority that has practical effects on people that are subject to it.
What is it?
The committee has the authority to subpoena witnesses to appear before subcommittees or investigators or the committee as a whole to testify under oath, to answer questions about any of their activities. The committee can make decisions to investigate for long periods of time and then decide to drop them. The committee has represented to the court that it has the authority to reach agreements with the subjects of investigations in order to drop proceedings if it will agree not to do certain actions. And the subcommittees have the authority to vote and recommend to the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee as a whole whether or not to bring the proceeding.
Now, and the proceeding you're talking about is?
The Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee can vote to bring a proceeding in district court to enjoin the activities that it contends are the Unauthorized Practice of Law.
But absent going to filing a lawsuit in court, you say they have the authority to issue a subpoena.
They issue subpoenas, they hold hearings and require people to come before them and testify under oath as to their activity. And they can do investigations, and they can, as they've said, they can reach settlements with parties before the filing of lawsuits to seek to regulate what their conduct is.
Of course, any individual who has a claim against any other individual could do any of those, except, I guess, an individual couldn't issue a subpoena unless they satisfied some rule of procedure on a pre-suit subpoena.
Well, that's good, but That's true. But in this case, the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee is not acting as an individual. What it's acting as is a delegee, that it tells us, of this court's authority to enforce the boundaries of the practice of law. That is, there is a committee that consists of private practice attorneys, and what they've been delegated is the authority, essentially, to define the boundaries of their own.
Does it also have public members?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't the committee also have public members?
Yes, there is a minority, or there's a requirement that there be a minority of 3 members that are non-attorneys by statute. And the current makeup of the committee is that there are 6 attorneys and 3 non-attorneys. And from the rules that the court has enacted governing the UPL committee, that majority of attorneys can adopt the rules themselves. And as far as we know, the majority of the attorneys can make the decision whether or not to file a lawsuit and whether or not to move forward with the proceeding. What's at issue in this case are 4 types of documents, 4 sets of information that don't...
Mr. Kennedy, before you move on to that, under what authority does this court have jurisdiction to issue a mandamus in this proceeding?
Under the court's inherent authority to regulate the practice of law. And that, Your Honor, that is a difficult question that I struggled with before I filed this. I initially felt that the appropriate place might be the district court. And then in reviewing the order that was issued by this court in September of 1986, the court had assumed to itself the power to regulate this very issue with the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee, entered an order in September of 1986 regarding what documents and under what conditions that the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee would release information to the public. I think it's at tab 6 of the merits brief.
And how would you distinguish the relief you're asking for from the relief that was sought in Gomez versus State Bar? I think the same question.
Yes. In the relief that was sought in Gomez was a order from a district court that would enact affirmative obligations on the attorneys of Texas to engage in mandatory pro bono. And the court's response to that was that type of regulation of attorneys is the exclusive jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. It's not the job of the district court to do that type of affirmative regulation.
And that regulation was on our administrative, we held it was on the administrative side of our docket and not on the legal side.
Right. The court said that it would consider that type of issue on the administrative docket. In dicta in Gomez, the court said that a district court could be empowered to review the constitutionality of a rule that this court has entered. And I think the issue in this case is what Nolan Press is doing now. Are we challenging the constitutionality of that September 1986 order in a general manner, which might be heard before the district court, or because Nolan Press is involved in a particular proceeding with the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee, is in a situation where it needs to get affirmative relief from the Supreme Court in an area where the Supreme Court itself has said it's exercising jurisdiction over, which is what the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee will and won't disclose to the public. So the difference between this case and Gomez is if Nolan Press were to go to the district court, there is no guarantee that Nolan Press could get the affirmative relief that would be necessary, while it potentially could get a ruling as to whether or not this court's rule is constitutional. And there's some question to that under the Declaratory Judgment Act, whether the Declaratory Judgment Act gives the district court authority to determine the constitutionality of a court rule rather than a statute. The Declaratory Judgment Act speaks in terms of statutes rather than court rules. Even if it could do that, there's no guarantee that the district court would have authority to grant affirmative relief and mandamus to the UPL committee to provide the information. And that's because, according to the language contained in the same order by the court, the Supreme Court says that the Uniform Practice of Law Committee is exercising authority on behalf of the Supreme Court. And in simple terms, I don't think mandamus could run uphill from a district court to what is an arm of the Supreme Court. And the UPL committee has stressed that connection between itself and the Supreme Court very heavily in its own merits, saying that what it is doing on behalf of the court. And I, in making the decision to file here rather than the district court and looking at that order, I felt it would be very difficult to convince a district judge that it had authority to mandamus an order in the district court.
If you had, if, as I read the order gives standing to this unauthorized practice of law committee to bring a lawsuit to seek enjoining some person, organization, activity that the committee determines the unauthorized practice of law. So the order simply says they have this standing to go to court to enforce the statute that requires people in the practice of law to be licensed. Now, why isn't the Declaratory Judgment Act available to NOLA Press to say, listen, they've notified us that they're going to investigate us. The only thing they can do as a result of this investigation is bring a lawsuit to try and enjoin our activities. Let's bring a declaratory judgment action in the trial court to declare whether or not we're violating any sort of statute in Texas. And then as a part of that, through discovery, seek who the members of the committee are and that sort of thing. And if the trial court denies it, then you bring that up as a mandamus on whether or not that's proper discovery. I mean, why is that not what ought to be going on here?
I think that procedure is available to NOLA Press, that it could go to the district court and say, this is what we do. We publish books. We don't practice law, and we need a determination from the court that, in fact, what we're doing is not publishing, is not practicing law, and if it was or defined as practicing law, it would violate the Constitution.
And you could virtually raise every issue you want to raise at that point.
I believe we could do that. What I would, I think NOLA Press would prefer not to get to that point.
But is mandamus an appropriate remedy to stop someone from bringing a lawsuit?
It's not the relief that NOLA Press is seeking from the court. We have not asked the Supreme Court to stop the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee from investigating NOLA Press or from bringing a lawsuit. What we are asking is in order to, from the Supreme Court, telling the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee that it needs to operate in the open, that its rules should be published, that they should be public and available to the subject of investigation.
And it is basically then somewhat analogous to a discovery dispute. You've asked for documents, the other side won't produce them, and so you're now here saying we won't produce.
To some degree, yes, Your Honor.
But you also just indicated when you answered Justice Eden's question that the Declaratory Judgment Act procedure is available to your client in the district court to declare your rights in this matter.
To declare the rights of the ultimate merits of the case of whether NOLA Press publications are the practice of law or are constitutionally protected,
so
even or that's available. What we're here before the court saying is it's more analogous to an open records case, which is why I labeled it a petition for writ of mandamus, because typically in open records cases you file a petition for mandamus.
Well, whether like it or not, the law under open records, the judiciary is exempt, and you recognize that because you said so in your application for mandamus.
And
so you're here on a common law due process claim.
Yes, right. Yeah, I mean, without conceding that the act does not apply,
well,
we have recognized.
You didn't bring it under that. So if you didn't bring it under that, how can you argue it?
And in this proceeding, we're not arguing that the open records.
Next question, and if it's a due process situation, how do you answer the two cases that the committee cited that there's no finality to what they're doing now, so you don't have due process protection?
Okay, there is no absolute finality to what the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee is doing. We concede that. But we do believe that there are principles of due process, equal protection, and open government that this court should apply to its own arms, just as the legislature has decided to apply that to the executive and the legislative branch, and that there should not be investigative and prosecutorial arms of any branch of government in Texas that takes the position that its rules shall not be public.
Well, but you've
and
got
members
no,
are
haven't secret. You gotten your, the rules? Is that correct or not? That's what they say in their response.
Some of the rules have been provided after the lawsuit was filed. We now have been told that there are additional materials that have not been provided. There are exhibits to the subcommittee rules that are being withheld. Identified within the subcommittee rules themselves, 7 exhibits, those are being withheld. They've also identified that there is a procedural There are other materials, other procedural guidelines, handbook, that is given to the committee and the subcommittee members when they join, and that they are also governed by that handbook. Those rules have not been produced, and my understanding is being withheld.
You don't have to go see any hearing with the unauthorized practice law, do you? This all began with an invitation, but just simply, if you don't come, then we might be inclined to think that there's something going on here. But, I mean, is there something here you're saying that you're being compelled to attend against your will and or anything like that in this case?
No, but it is a proceeding that can substantially affect the practical manner of the rights of my client.
Well, let me ask you, if you have a client who comes to you and says, I want to file a lawsuit against XYZ. I think they've done me wrong. And you write a demand letter. You say either cease and desist what you're doing or pay us a bunch of money. And the other side says, no, I don't want to. I mean, do you ever call them to see if we can't resolve this before we file a lawsuit?
Sure, that's a possibility.
But you don't have to. But what really happens is you threaten them with a lawsuit. You said we need to negotiate this out, and they can attend or not attend. But the ultimate result will simply be you either file your lawsuit or you don't file your lawsuit. Is there a due process notion to this pre-suit process? I mean, does the defendant have some sort of due process right to sit down and talk with you before you bring the lawsuit?
Well, there's two parallel things going on here. One is that no press has been individually drawn into this proceeding with the unauthorized practice of law to be.
Would a defendant out there be individually drawn in by a plaintiff?
Right.
You know, lots of defendants say, hey, we didn't do anything.
Sure, and there is another theme running in this, involved in that process, no press came to the realization that the process is very close to secret. And that there are
Process with your client is close to secret. Process, all you want to do is talk to the defendant and see what the defendant's story is, but your process with your own client is secret as well until you finally file your lawsuit.
Right, but this is a government agency that is bound by rules. And it is a government agency that has that can exercise government authority and can file lawsuits if it chooses. And it isn't until we filed this lawsuit that we found out that the subcommittee was actually bound by rules. This court itself, in its 1980 order, ordered that the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee enact rules. It shall adopt rules. And it listed six different areas where the court was concerned that the committee should adopt rules, including things such as recusal of members in the case where it's possible that there is either a real or a perceived conflict of interest. The court was concerned about the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee being governed by the rule of law. It appears that the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee has not, in fact, adopted rules governing itself.
But your client might have some internal rules about conflict before his board of directors determines whether to bring a lawsuit. Would that be a basis for a defendant to come in and say, I need to have all the information to make a determination somehow about whether or not I can be sued or something?
Perhaps. Well, my client is not the government. And government agencies are bound to follow their own rules. And they're bound by the Supreme Court's order to not have members participate in the process if there is an apparent or real conflict of interest. So without access to the rules, without access to information of the individuals who are involved in the process, then those who are subject these rules aren't self-enforcing. There's no way to investigate and see whether or not the people involved in the investigation, voting on the recommendation, voting on the decision to file a lawsuit, have in fact avoided the appearance of the reality of the conflict of interest.
Before you sit down, I want to make sure. I understood you to say that you agreed with Justice Heenan's hypothetical that you have available with the Declaratory Judgment Act proceeding in a district court to declare your rights.
Only to the extent to declare the ultimate right about whether what.
But you also agree that within the framework of that type of litigation, you have discovery rights too.
Yes.
And but therefore you can go to a district court and ask by a motion to compel the same thing you're asking this court to give you.
Only if NOLA Press is forced to go and to challenge the merits of whether or not what it does is an unauthorized practice of law. NOLA Press would like to see this go away long before that stage. You think that
well, we'll probably all agree with that, yes. Do you also agree then if you were denied your motion to compel, you'd have a right of mandamus at that time from the district courts?
That's an open question because it's
well, why
not,
wouldn't you?
Well, it's not clear whether a district court could mandamus the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee to do something which the committee feels is in violation of this court's 1986 order. We still would be in a position of asking a district court to mandamus uphill, even if we were involved in a proceeding that involved the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee. We still have this 1986 order, which the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee reads as prohibiting it from releasing any of this information to the public. Now, we don't agree with this interpretation of this order, and we might convince a district judge that our interpretation of the order is correct, but what we cannot get is affirmative relief from the district court, I believe, that would tell an arm of this court what to do, because I think the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee would be in a position to say, no, we're the Supreme Court, and we don't have to obey
well,
orders from the Supreme Court.
Well, does the same rationale say that you don't appear, you don't get any information, a recommendation is made to sue for an injunction against NOLA Press, that lawsuit's filed, you respond, you still have the same discovery rights there to ask for everything you're asking for now?
We might, and we may run into the same problem. That is, we can't get
side, in other words, on either side of this issue, yeah. There's a legal remedy available.
But I don't agree, Your Honor, because either way it is raised, if it's raised during a lawsuit on the merits, we still face the difficulty of getting a district court to order an arm of this court to produce information when its position is it is controlled by in order that this court is entered itself.
The State Board of Law Examiners and the State Bar of Texas, two entities, have considerable regulatory power over people's lives, and they are sued more than occasionally in district court over issues of remedies. Why is this order, Supreme Court passed, carrying out a legislative mandate on UPL different than other Supreme Court orders?
I think in this case it's different, and the committee is telling us it's different. It's because what the committee is doing on behalf of the court, and what the State Bar is doing, it is doing on behalf of the legislature. And that the Supreme Court has recognized that in this particular area of the UPL to the release or non-release of the information that no one receives.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court, Ms. Linda Acevedo will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, this proceeding contemplates the utilization of an extraordinary remedy, writ of mandamus, against Mr. Rodney Gilstrap, the chair of this court's Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee. And it would be wrong for this court to exercise its original mandamus jurisdiction in this manner when there has been no showing of a violation of any duty imposed by law.
Does the court have the jurisdiction?
Under mandamus, I don't think it's appropriate.
They should go to the district court.
I believe that there's an adequate remedy at law in addition to the fact that they haven't met their burden as to a violation of a duty imposed by law or even raised a complaint about an abuse of discretion. There is an adequate remedy at law. There are factual disputes still out there.
So your respondent's position is that this can be fully litigated and an order, appropriate orders issued by the district court.
And ultimately, this court may exercise its regular appellate jurisdiction over some of the rulings that are made and, in fact, might exercise mandamus jurisdiction with respect to a district court's ruling on some of these issues. But in a sense, it's really actually premature and they haven't met what they need to meet to get this extraordinary remedy from the court at this time.
Briefly summarize, what are the factual disputes and what are the adequate remedies at law that are made?
All right, if I can go through the information that they've asked for. All right, they've asked for the rules and procedures. Right. Our position is they have all of the committee's rules and procedures. They've been provided with those.
What about the exhibits?
And
the
exhibits are not there, and there's some dispute over both the forms that are utilized by the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee in their investigations and the handbook as well. And it's our position that they aren't rules or regulations, but they're clearly records and documents covered by the confidentiality order.
Why are the exhibits covered by the confidentiality order?
I think you can argue that they're records and documents of the committee. I think you can also argue that these are forms that they utilize within their investigations and litigation. For example, in the handbook, this is a handbook that was developed specifically to aid the members to conduct effective investigations and litigation. It contains advice and opinions and sort of strategies, I guess, or litigation forms in there. You know, and the committee can't see how anybody, much less a potential adversary, would be entitled to those kinds of documents. So, and the document is not before the court. It's not before the court to be reviewed, and without that, it doesn't seem that the court would be in a position to order the production of those. So either they have all the rules and regulations and the issue is moot, or there still exists a dispute with respect to the nature of the documents that are not before the court. The next issue is the minutes and the agenda. The minutes and the agendas clearly are covered by the confidentiality rule. It's important to understand that UPL meetings consist almost entirely of discussions of ongoing investigations, pending and anticipated litigation.
Can you say this is a factual issue?
Oh, with respect to the factual issue,
I thought you were outlining the factual issues, the reason mandamus couldn't be granted because there were disputed facts.
Of the disputed facts, again, these agendas and minutes are not before the court. There are claims of confidentiality within the minutes that the committee does claim, and it seems to me that if these documents are not before the court, that they can't be ordered to be produced without knowing the extent of the confidential information that is within it. Those are the two documents, I think, or the two items of information that's been requested, that there are, it seems to me, disputes with respect to what's actually within them. But in addition to that,
why couldn't they be submitted for in-camera inspection by this court?
I could not find any case in which an original mandamus proceeding was filed where the documents had not been, that were produced to the court without having first been produced, for example, before a district court in camera, and then the records sent up to the Supreme Court. Even the A&T case, I think, that's cited in their brief, I think that's distinguishable, one, because it was brought pursuant to the Texas Open Records Act, and two, because I believe this court exercised jurisdiction because it believed that it was the only court that had the ability to mandamus an executive officer of the state. So I think that case can be distinguishable. And even in that case, it didn't look to me as if the documents had actually been submitted to the court for in-camera. So I could find no mechanism available for that.
So if indeed the district court didn't have jurisdiction over this dispute, this case would be like Sharp.
It seems to me that what they're really complaining about is the confidentiality rule. They say it covers records and documents of the committee, don't really think that this is right. And they can challenge that. That's an actual rule of the court. They can challenge that in district court. I think it is analogous to both the Chenault case and the Gomez case of the court. In those cases, the court said, our inherent power to regulate the practice of law are administrative powers. They're not jurisdictional powers. And just because we maintain the ultimate authority to regulate the practice of law doesn't mean that we're going to assume exclusive jurisdiction over any action affecting that authority. And just because it's a rule of the court doesn't change that. Lawyers challenge the rules of professional conduct, which are also rules of this court, the rules of disciplinary procedure, which are also rules of this court, all the time in district court. In fact, just last term, this court ultimately exercised appellate jurisdiction to a challenge of one of the disciplinary rules. So that appears to be an avenue that is certainly available to that court. They can make all of these same arguments. A district court is certainly capable of considering any arguments with respect to that, including constitutional ones. And ultimately, this court may very well exercise appellate jurisdiction over any ruling that a district court could make. I think it's also important to understand that subcommittee or proceedings before subcommittees do not carry finality. I think some of the questions have gone to the respect of that. The names of the subcommittee members have been an issue that has been raised in the brief, and it's important, again, for the court to recognize that the committees are made up entirely of volunteer lawyers and non-lawyers. The system's completely dependent upon their service. And unlike the grievance committees, they don't have any paid staff, investigators or litigators. They have no administrative staff that acts as a kind of buffer between them and the public at large. They conduct all of their own investigations and litigation. And these subcommittee members have no power to enjoin anyone's activities in the states. They don't adjudicate matters. They don't enter judgments. The extent of their authority collectively is simply to recommend that a lawsuit be filed to the state committee.
Mr. Kennedy says, though, they can issue subpoenas and put people under oath and compel them to appear.
Well, the subcommittee themselves cannot issue subpoenas. If you actually look at the rules, it's only the state committee who is authorized to issue subpoenas. The subcommittee has to actually get authority or permission from the state committee to do that. And in practice, they rarely do so. I think in the documents that you have there, you can see that most of the meetings that they have are informal. They are tape recorded.
But they do have the authority to do that. You can see that.
The subcommittee, yes, can
get
their
identities from be kept from the public?
Pardon me?
Why should their identities be kept from the public?
Again, I think if you look at the fact, I think there are several reasons. One is, as I was saying, that they have no ability themselves to actually enjoin anybody's activities. I think the effect of releasing their names of individuals who have no ultimate power or authority to enjoin anybody's activities could subject them to undue harassment. I don't think the Republic of Texas would hesitate.
Are grand juror names and addresses released to the public?
I don't know if they are or not. I was always under the impression that they were not released.
Does this subcommittee or even the state committee have the power of a grand jury?
Of a grand jury? No, a grand jury, the end result of a grand jury would actually be to issue an information or indictment that becomes the basis, I believe, of the criminal charge or lawsuit.
Is there a basis? The recommendation of this committee or the state committee could simply result only in the bringing of a civil lawsuit that would have all the discovery rules, rules of civil procedure, rule 76A, all applicable to that. Is there any reason why a different view of the publicness of the members of the committee be than members of a grand jury? Need to know who these people are. They're making these major decisions.
Well, I think that there are protections that are built into the way that the process works that can take care of that. They bring up questions about potentials for abuse. Well, the matter may never reach district court, so it may never actually become relevant. And second, even if you say there is some particular member with some sort of axe to grind, they still have to convince a subcommittee to recommend a lawsuit. They still have to get authorization from the state committee to actually authorize a lawsuit. And once you get into district court, you have available to you, it seems to me there are procedural mechanisms that are built into the system to address those complaints. In fact, the lawsuit that Nello Press actually raises in their brief, the case pending in Harris County, where they had some questions or suspicions about the particular lawyer who was acting on behalf of the UPL committee, the respondents did just that. They were represented by highly competent counsel, and they raised all of these complaints to the district judge regarding the motives of the particular lawyer and due process concerns and complaints. And the district court is certainly capable of and duly considered all of those arguments. And it seems to me that given the fact that when you come to the meeting, the identity of the members are identified to you. When you get there, the subcommittees require the individuals who are present to sign in, and so you know who is there when you come there. It's simply, I think the real issue is that the names simply just aren't released to the public at large. And the reason the committee has done that before, and as I've said, is to sort of protect them, I guess, from any sort of undue harassment, being sued individually, or, I mean, like the Republic of Texas having liens placed on their property, and
does
given
the Public Information Act require a district attorney's office to release the names of its assistants, its lawyers, and its investigators?
I believe that it is covered by the Texas Public Information Act. That's correct. But anyway, if you want to have reasons as to why they have not done it, those are the reasons why they have not done it before.
Why was the committee so reluctant to provide its rules of procedure to Nello Press?
We thought that they had the rules and procedures. And once we learned that they did not have them, they were provided to them immediately. So I can't really answer.
It wasn't until after this lawsuit was filed.
That's correct. And I don't have an answer for that. I only know that I thought that they had them, and when we learned that they didn't have them, we provided it to them, and they have all of the rules and procedures now.
How is this, how are these issues different than Gomez?
The difference in Gomez, I think, if I recall in that case, was that the court said what those plaintiffs were seeking were a new regulation, some new requirement that wasn't already in existence. If I recall in Gomez, the court said, you know, if we actually had rules out there, if we had actually promulgated rules out there, then the district court would have been in a position to consider any attacks on any rules that were out there. They have, obviously, jurisdiction to consider any complaints against rules that have been promulgated. And that's why I think that this is analogous, is that you have promulgated rules that can be attacked in district court in the same way that you could attack any other statute or rule of the court. But I think in Gomez that what they were asking for was a new requirement, that lawyers actually be required to perform a certain number of hours of pro bono work.
But they claim that there were constitutional bases for that. They didn't just argue that as policy. So there were legal reasons why that should be done.
I'm trying to remember what they were, but I believe that it was more of a policy argument than anything else at that time. And I do think it is, again, analogous to the Chenault case, where the lawyers made the same kind of argument where, well, look, you regulate the practice of law. You ultimately decide what is or what isn't going to be done, and that's why we've come to you directly. And I think the court in there said, look, those powers are administrative. They're not necessarily jurisdictional. And that's why we're here saying that mandamus relief is not appropriate. Before you even get to the adequate remedy at law, I think you have to show that there's been a violation of some duty imposed by law. Nolo Press has failed to cite to a single statute that would have required Mr. Gilstrap to disclose this information. In fact, the only rule out there is the confidentiality rule. They haven't argued that he abused his discretion. And so before you even get to the adequate remedy, I think they have those problems as well. Nor does mandamus appear to be appropriate for this court to exercise its rulemaking authority. They say, well, could you modify or change the rule and make it more clear to us? Again, it seems like that's directly at odds with what mandamus proceedings are supposed to be about, and this court has said before that it will not exercise its rulemaking authority by way of judicial opinion. It would probably set a bad precedent. Anybody who would ever have a complaint against the committee would come straight to this court to try to get it resolved. As it is, just the granting of the petition has halted some investigations in the UPL process. There have been other individuals who have said they were going to bring mandamus actions, and we would just urge the court that in considering this case, that Nolo Press is not going to be without adequate remedy. They're not going to be in a position to not at least ask for relief in another forum, and that not to grant a writ of mandamus against one of this court's, the chair of one of this court's committees.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Very briefly. There is a fundamental difference between rules that this court has enacted, orders that this court has enacted regarding its own committee, unauthorized practice of law committee, and rules that this court may promulgate governing procedures in lower courts. And the fundamental difference is that the lower courts are not, I do not believe, are in a position to grant relief against an arm of this court based on its determination of whether or not those rules meet constitutional challenge. The Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee has said that we should have gone to district court and filed an open records lawsuit because district courts have original jurisdiction over open records lawsuits, while at the same time they're saying they're not subject to the Open Records Act. And so it seems inconsistent to take the position we should be going to the district court for relief while at the same time saying that relief is not available. The members of the Unauthorized Practices Law Subcommittee are not grand jury. And there's two reasons why they're significantly different. One is a grand jury is not asked to and authorized to participate in investigations and prosecutions to determine the scope of their own professional interests, of their own profession. The Unauthorized Practices Law Committee is unique in Texas in that it is given the legal authority to investigate and then to enforce through lawsuits the boundaries of its own profession. This is not self-regulation. This is not attorneys regulating their own profession. This is private attorneys who do the lion's share of defining the boundaries of who can be an attorney and what an attorney does. It's fundamentally different from what a grand jury does. Another reason they're fundamentally different from grand juries is because grand juries exist as a check on governmental power. In fact, a grand jury is there in order to make sure and be a check on a prosecutor before a lawsuit is filed. What the subcommittee members do is they are the investigative and prosecutorial arm of this court. They are not there as a check. And so there is a greater need for the public accountability for these people because they are not acting on behalf of the public. They are asked to be an investigative and prosecutorial arm.
Are the subcommittee members, lawyers?
I'm sorry?
The subcommittee members, are they all lawyers or do they have non-lawyers?
I don't know, Your Honor. One of the reasons I'm here is I don't know who's on the subcommittee. The only subcommittee members who have been identified from Novo Press are all attorneys.
If you were to show up at one of the hearings, you would find out.
Well, we would know who showed up at the hearing. But there's no requirement that all of the subcommittee members attend the hearing. The rules that they produced said that a quarter of a subcommittee constitutes a quorum, so that an eighth of a subcommittee plus one could vote to decide. So I don't know, and we don't know, and there's no requirement, as there is in the statute, that there be any percentage of non-lawyers on the subcommittee. Non-lawyers are, by rule, can be on the subcommittees, but we don't know the composition. And the public of Texas does not know whether the subcommittee is dominated entirely by lawyers in private practice or whether there is some balance.
If we move this over to the administrative docket and we just simply said that when a person receives a letter of inquiry, that person's entitled to receive the members of the subcommittee and their addresses and the copy of the rules and procedures that will be used for this informal hearing, does that satisfy everything you're interested in?
That would address two out of four of the issues.
What are the other two?
The other two. One is that Novo Press believes that basic information about meeting times, schedules, and agendas should be released.
Well, of course, you'd have to know where the meeting is.
Well, and in general, not just the one for a particular investigation, but in general. For instance, this case has raised a good issue as to why that information should be available to the public. And I can see that there may be some information in minutes and agendas that could be redacted, but that's commonly done in open records.
If the meetings are open to the public, what good does it do to know where and when they occur?
I'm sorry?
If the meetings are not open to the public, what good does it do you to know when and where they are?
Well, to simply know that the meetings are taking place, they take place on a regular basis, so that the people of Texas will know how its government is acting. For instance, in this case, there is still an open question, and I don't believe it's fact issue, but it's an open question about when and whether these subcommittee rules were actually adopted. The only copy that's been produced is an undated, unsigned version of the rules. And the UPL committee is unable to say anything other than that these rules were adopted sometime before July 23rd, 1981.
Well, let's go. So you want the rule to be that if they're going to have a meeting that they do what? They post the notice of the meeting, but they note that it's not open to the public, or that would satisfy number three.
Something to that extent. I said that these are the dates that we meet on a regular basis, and when they meet to discuss things that are not confidential,
well,
such as promulgating rules.
Okay. Unlike the Open Meetings Act that limits them, you wouldn't. Of course, these are volunteers showing up. So, It would be okay if the rule said if the meeting gets canceled, they can meet even if the notice doesn't go out, can't they? Or would you say they, unless they send out the notice, they can't meet?
We're not asking relief that would have this court essentially enact a version of the Open Meetings Act for this committee. What our specific request is we would like documents that reflect the meetings that have taken place and the dates and schedules to the extent the documents exist, and to the extent
there's... In the past or prospective?
I believe the request was for 1997 and 1998, and then if there are documents reflecting future meetings when they're scheduled, that's what we requested. We're not asking the court to create a structure by which actions of the committee are or aren't validated, so, depending on how they meet.
Of course, the rule would have to operate prospectively, but the rule would be that upon request, they should distribute whatever is on their calendar for when their meetings are scheduled and where they'll be meeting.
That the information is public rather than secret.
Okay. Then, number four, what's the last one?
And the fourth is a particular request to Nolo Press. And Nolo Press has asked for documents related to itself and is focusing on two individual matters. One is information regarding the identity of the complainant against it, and information regarding the scope of the investigation. Nolo Press publishes over 100-some titles and has not been given notice as to whether one, some, or all of its titles are at issue. One title that has been mentioned.
As to the complaint, are you seeking anything more than just the nature of the complaint, or are you seeking the name of the complainant?
The nature of the complaint and the source of the complainant, whether it was a private citizen, whether it was a member of the subcommittee or a member of the bar. In this particular instance, we don't see any confidentiality concerns. There may be in certain cases. In this instance, we don't see them because of the nature of Nolo Press's business. It does not develop individual relationships. It doesn't have confidential relationships with clients or individuals. It simply distributes and publishes books. And so we think it's an important thing for Nolo Press and the public to know as to whether or not the alleged complaint against it has been generated by a member of the bar concerned about competition or about some dissatisfied customer who's not satisfied with the quality of those publications.
Did you have competitors in the private competitors in your same market?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what if it was a competitor who was just unhappy with the competition that you furnished?
Well, that we would like to know as well. I think it would be unlikely because the competitors would be shooting themselves in but to raise the issue that what they're doing may not be permitted by Texas law. But that's the fourth possibility.
So there's no reason why the complaint is made
in this particular instance.
But you're asking us to make rules for everyone, and you do recognize that in some situations it would not be appropriate to release the name of a complaint.
It may be. There may be where there is some type of personal relationship between the complainant and the subject of the complaint with disclosure of it would cause difficulty. We recognize that. We don't see that as being the situation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
Well, the